So our study tonight is the third chapter of Deuteronomy, having finished the second chapter last time. The setting now is the time when the children of Israel are finishing their 40-year time in the wilderness. They have gotten over to the east bank of the Jordan River in the area of Mount Pisgah, and they have completely overrun the kingdom of Heshbon and King Sihon. They've gotten up to the river Jabbok, which is probably comes into the mid portion of the Jordan River, and they were not to proceed any further. Now, beginning in the third chapter, we have them going on and capturing more of this territory. Deuteronomy 3, verse 1, "Then we turned and went up the way to Bashan. And Og, the king of Bashan, came out against us, he and all his people, to battle at Edrei." Now, this Edrei is way up in this area of the map. Bashan was quite a large territory. We see that it runs from the Jabbok River all the way up to Mount Hermon. And then it includes the territory back over to Mount Gilead, a large territory. And we're going to also see that this King Og ruled about 60 walled cities. And there were other cities included that weren't ruled. So it was a large territory that he ruled. He was an Amorite king. And we'll learn later in this chapter that he was one of the, maybe the last of the giants in this area. This was a land of giants. Verse 2, "And the Lord said unto me, Fear him not, for I will deliver him and all his people and his land into thy hand, and thou shalt do unto him as thou didst unto Sihon, king of the Amorites, which dwelt at Heshbon." And last time we discussed in chapter 2 how they did completely overrun the land of Heshbon and King Sihon. "So the Lord our God delivered into our hands Og also, the king of Bashan, and all his people. And we smote him until none was left to him remaining. And we took all his cities at that time. There was not a city which we took not from them, 70 cities, all the region of Argob, the kingdom of Og in Bashan." And no one is sure exactly where Argob is, but it's somewhere in the territory of Bashan. And it's not necessary for us to have to pinpoint it on the map. "All these cities were fenced with high walls, gates, and bars, besides unwalled towns a great many." Now, it may be difficult for us to realize just what a victory this is. But not only was it a large territory, but we're talking about 60 cities that were important enough to have walls built around them. Walls and gates and bars over the wall. And then he said a great many unwalled cities. So a tremendous number of people were involved here. If you had 500 people to the city, that would be 30,000 people. So it could amount to quite a large number of people. And this is not counting all that didn't live in the cities and these many unwalled cities. "And we utterly destroyed them, as we did unto Sihon, king of Heshbon, utterly destroying the men, women, and children of every city." Now this sounds like a gruesome, unpleasant situation. But this is a part of God's judgment on these people, and it's a part of God's judgment to carry out his will regarding his people. You must remember that these people were completely disregarding God. They were going about every kind of wickedness, idolatry that could be imagined, just as society does today. They gave no thought at all for God. And so God had a better use to make of this territory than to let them live there. He had a people that were his people that he'd promised that could have this territory. And so he had a better use for it. And it's something for us to bear in mind ourselves today. If God has a better use for what we have than to let us have it, or for where we live than to let us live there, or for the possession we have in the way of any kind of land or territory than to let us possess it, then he has every right and every reason, maybe, then to dispossess us. So it's quite an interesting thing then when you, and frightening thing when you stop to think about the fact that we do owe God something. We owe God our allegiance and our wholehearted support, and to give him praise and honor and glory and to serve him, which these people were not doing. So they utterly destroyed them, utterly destroying the men, women, and children of every city. But all the cattle and the spoil of the cities we took for a prey to ourselves. Now, of course, the cattle were not guilty of any kind of a sin or disobedience to God. The cattle were innocent creatures, and they could be, of course, to great benefit, and they were kept and preserved, and the spoil of the cities. And we took at that time out of the hand of the two kings of the Amorites the land that was on this side Jordan from the river of Arnon unto Mount Hermon. Now this is a long territory. The river Arnon comes in through the middle of the Dead Sea all the way up to Mount Hermon. That's the territory that they took now when they destroyed these two nations and these two kings, Sihon of Heshbon and Og of Bashan. Then when he mentions Mount Hermon, he has a parenthesis in verse 9, which Hermon the Sidonians call Sirion, and the Amorites call it Shinar. Now the Sidonians lived over here in this the area of Sidon, and the Amorites, of course, are way the other side, on the east side of Mount Gilead. So he just gives the two names that these two different people gave to this one mountain, Mount Hermon. Now, Mount Hermon is quite an important mountain when you're studying Bible geography, because it is the origin of the waters that feed Lake Hula or Lake Merom. And then the waters of Merom run on down, and it becomes the origin of the waters of the Sea of Shinnereth or the Sea of Galilee. And many of the events that happened in our Savior's ministry happened around the area of the Sea of Galilee. And there's an area there called the Decapolis, which is the 10 cities in that region. And many of his miracles and teachings and of the record that we have in the Gospels are in that area. And then, of course, the Sea of Galilee is the origin of the Jordan River that flows 60 miles southward and on down into the Dead Sea or the Sea of the Plain. And so this Mount Hermon is an interesting and vital area to know about when we're studying Bible geography and Bible history. So this territory went all the way up to Mount Hermon. All the cities of the plain, and all Gilead, and all Bashan, unto Salca and Edrei, cities of the kingdom of Og and Bashan. So he's just recounting here the territory that was now theirs. They had captured it. They'd completely obliterated all of the dwelling people there, capturing their cities, completely killing all the men, women, and children, and subduing everything that could be of any obstacle to them. Now, we might mention in passing that this is really the way that God wanted them to do when they went into Canaan. He wanted them to completely obliterate the people who existed there. And one of the failings of the children of Israel was that they did not do this. They went in and occupied the land, and they allowed themselves to cohabit or co-occupy some of these areas with the people already living there, and consequently that was a beginning of many, many of their problems. For only Og, king of Bashan, remained of the remnant of giants. Behold, his bedstead was a bedstead of iron. Is it not in Rabbath of the children of Ammon? Now, Rabbath was a city over here that belonged to the Ammonites, and it was kind of the capital of the territory of the Ammonites. Now, remember, the Ammonites were somewhat kin to the children of Israel. They were descendants of Lot and his youngest daughter. So they would be cousins. Whereas the Moabites were descendants of Lot and his oldest daughter, they were cousins. So the Ammonites were not to be interfered with, and that was their territory. So it seemed that somehow or other there might have been some kind of a battle or struggle in which this bedstead of King Og had been captured and taken over there to Rabath as a kind of a trophy, because he mentions that that's where it is now. It was maybe in a museum, and a very historic piece. This is the last of the giant Amorite kings, and here's his bedstead. And one of the great things about it was not just that it was iron, but that it was 9 cubits was the length thereof, and 4 cubits the breadth thereof, after the cubit of a man. 9 cubits would be 14.5 feet, I believe, making each cubit 18 inches, and 4 cubits would be 6 feet. So you got a bedstead here that's 14.5 feet wide, and long, and 6 feet wide. Now, assuming that you leave him plenty of room to lay in, he could have been a man 12 feet tall and still had plenty of room to have laid in this bedstead of 14.5 feet. And there's no use for us to try to speculate on how tall he was, but if he needed a bedstead that large, then he was quite a large man. And he is referred to as a giant. He was he remained of the remnant of giants. So that was what was left of the giants. He was one of them. And we do have, as we mentioned the last time, many references in the Bible to these giants. The Rephaims is another name for them. When David went out and battled Goliath, he was one of the giants. When the 12 spies went up into Canaan to spy at the land, they came across these giants. They said, we're like grasshoppers in their eyes. And that was one of the reasons they gave for not being able to go on in and take the land back originally at Kadesh Barnea. So that's interesting about the bedstead of Og. Verse 12, and this land which we possessed at that time from Aroer, which is by the river Arnon, and half Mount Gilead, and the cities thereof, gave I unto the Reubenites and to the Gadites. Now, from this river Arnon, which runs into the Dead Sea, and extending on up northward to the half the distance of Mount Gilead, which is a mountain range. It goes about 60 miles long here, or rather 40 miles long. He gave that territory to the Reubenites and the Gadites. And you can see how this map has it marked off. This green area is the territory of Reuben, and the orange area is the territory of Gad. And these are two of the original 12 tribes, or 12 sons of Jacob, and they were allowed to settle on the east side of the Jordan River. And we're going to talk about that a little bit more just a little bit later, but let's just bear in mind now that 2.5 of the tribes did settle east of the Jordan, Reuben, Gad, and half of Manasseh. Manasseh was a son of Joseph. Joseph had 2 sons who were given tribes to take the place of the Levites who did not have a tribe, and to take the place of himself who did not have a tribe. And the other son was Ephraim. And the rest of Gilead and all Bashan, being the kingdom of Og, gave I unto the half-tribe of Manasseh, all the region of Argob with all Bashan, which was called the land of giants. So they had this northern territory here for Manasseh, which is the pink area on this map. And it was really what was the bulk of the kingdom of Bashan. And it was given to the half-tribe of Manasseh. Now, as we get into the 14th verse, we get into a few names that are a little difficult for me to give a good explanation of. Verse 14. Jair, the son of Manasseh, took all the country of Argob unto the coast of Geshuri and Maachathi, and called them after his own name, Bashan hath for Jair unto this day. Now this Geshuru and Maachathi, that's the name of 2 different groups of people, just showing that he took the land where these people were, or in the border where these people were. And he called them after his own name, and he gave it the name of Bashan, which is that original territory, Havan, Jer, when Jer was his name. And he said it's called that unto this day. Now he says Jer, the son of Manasseh, and he tells what part of that territory that Jer took. Now we read, when we try to study the history of Jer, that he was a descendant of the tribe of Judah, and his father, rather, was a descendant of the tribe of Judah, and his mother was a descendant of the tribe of Manasseh. So a member of the tribe of Judah and a woman from the tribe of Manasseh married and had Jer. And then Jer became a representative of Manasseh to the point that he was given a large part, he and his family, given a large part of his territory. We read back in Numbers 27, and I won't turn over there and read that, the story of a group of people called the daughters of Zelophehad. The daughters of Zelophehad. Now, Zelophehad was a man who lived back when the children of Israel were in the wilderness 40 years. And he died a natural death while in that wilderness. He wasn't one that went off with any of the ones who rebelled against Moses. And he didn't have any sons. And so when they started distributing territory out, these daughters of Zelophehad came to him and said, well, look, it's not fair. Our father didn't have any sons, and he didn't do anything particularly wrong. He died for his own sins, not because he was following after anybody else. And so we think that you should let us take his possession. What, instead of, since he didn't have any sons to pass it on to, let it go to his daughters. And so Moses considered this and consulted with God about it, and they decided, yes, this would be the right thing. They've got a good point. And so they set up a statute whereby that if a man died and didn't have any sons, that his daughters could inherit the property. And so that seems to me to be the way that Jer came in to being called the son of Manasseh, is probably through this rule that was made for the daughters of Zelophehad. Now, they passed another rule also to go along with this so that somebody couldn't take the territory out of the original family that it was supposed to belong to and transfer it to another tribe using this statute. They passed another rule then that said that a daughter could only marry in her own tribe. She couldn't marry out of the tribe, and that became later a general rule for all of Israel, that a daughter had to marry in her own tribe, which meant that a son had to marry in his own tribe. And however, this wasn't in effect, evidently, in the case of Jer, because his father was of the tribe of Judah and his mother was of the tribe of Manasseh. And so that rule that we read about back there in Numbers 27 and that situation with the daughters of Zelophehad may very well be something that would help to explain the situation of Jer being called the son of Manasseh and being given a large part of this territory. Then we read in the next verse, verse 15, "And I gave Gilead unto Machir." Now Machir was a son of Manasseh, and as I understand it, he was not only the oldest son, but the only son of Manasseh. And so he was given what was called Gilead, and we know Gilead was a mountain range. It was 40 miles long and 20 miles wide that extended along this area. And we learn from the study of Bible history that he became a very powerful person. As a matter of fact, his family eventually took over to the point of being the predominant family of Manasseh. And sometimes in the Bible, whenever they speak of Manasseh, they're really talking about Machir, and vice versa, when they speak of Machir, they're really talking about Manasseh. That's how powerful he and his family became. So these are very interesting and pertinent details to the astute student of Bible history and who would like to really keep these things straight for future reference as we go in and study in later books, and there some of these things are mentioned in more detail. Now in verse 16, "And unto the Reubenites and unto the Gadites I gave from Gilead even unto the river Arnon half the valley, and the border even unto the river Jabbok, which is the border of the children of Ammon. The plain also, and Jordan, and the coast thereof, from Shinnereth, even unto the sea of the plain, even the salt sea, under Ashdod, Pisgah, eastward." Now, they had these other two tribes, Reuben and Gad, they had quite a territory given to them. They begin way down here at the Arnon River, and they take all of this plain, all of the Jordan River, and they extend all the way up to the Sea of Shinnereth, which is the Lake of Galilee. You can see how that the map goes right up to the very corner of it. And they got all of that river there, Jordan River, and that's their territory. And they go right over to the border of the children of Ammon. Now remember, the children of Ammon over here were not to be interfered with, but they got right to their border. Now the story of this is in Numbers 32. Numbers, the 32nd chapter. We're not going to turn over and read it because it takes up quite a few verses. But I'd just like to talk a little bit about what Numbers 32 says. When it was time for them to consider going over into Canaan, the representatives of these tribes came to Moses and said, "Don't make us inherit the land of Canaan. Let us settle over here. This is good grazing land. And we have a lot of cattle, and we're perfectly contented to stay right here. This is very well-suited land for us." Well, that has a lot of ramifications when you stop and think about it. First of all, it is a lot of territory. It's only 2.5 tribes. And second of all, it looks like on the surface that they're trying to get out of going into Canaan and doing any fighting. Looks like they're trying to get out of taking the land that God originally intended for them to take. Here, their land was already taken. And so they were satisfied. Just let us have this. And it is good land. All the travelers who've been there and written of that area describe it as being ideal pasture land. And so Moses then, contemplating the fact that maybe they were trying to get out of going in and doing their share of taking Canaan, he talked pretty straight to them. And he said, "You know, this is beginning to be the same condition we had down at Kadesh Barnea. When God wanted them to go in and take it, they refused to go, and he punished them by making them stay in the wilderness 40 years and making them all die who were over the age of 20 before they could have had a chance to go into the true land. And now you're doing the same thing, and you're going to cause all these people here to miss getting to inherit the Canaan land." And so they came back with a proposal that, no, they would go in and fight. They would go in, let them secure their little ones and their families, and they would go in and fight and help conquer the land of Canaan, and then they would come back and occupy this land. They would just leave their families behind, they'd come back and occupy. So you see how they really still had a real good deal. They didn't have to take their families or the little ones into this foreign country. They were already settled here. The cattle already said they'd have to move any of that. And it was really a good deal for them. And so that was the agreement. They had an agreement all made then. And so he covers it a little bit right here. Verse 18. "And I commanded you at that time, saying, The Lord your God hath given you this land to possess it. You shall pass over armed before your brethren, the children of Israel, all that are meet for the war." Now then, you can have it, you can possess it, but all of your people that are appropriate or that are able to go to war, you arm them, and they'll pass over, he says here, before your brethren, the children of Israel. You're going to lead everybody. You go first. "But your wives and your little ones and your cattle, for I know that you have much cattle, shall abide in your cities which I have given you, until the Lord hath given rest unto your brethren, as well as unto you, until they also possess the land which the Lord your God hath given them beyond Jordan, and then shall you return every man unto his possession, which I have given you." So they were to go over Jordan and fight until the Lord had given them rest and their brethren rest. That is, they had satisfactorily conquered the land, and then they could come back. They weren't to rebuild the cities. They were to only just put up walls enough to protect their cattle and their sheep. And so that's an interesting point here when we see how that really came about, that they did and were allowed to settle that part of the territory east of Jordan. Another interesting thing here is that they did settle their territory first. They were given their territory first. But we found as we study that whenever the people had become so corrupt and so wicked that God was ready to start letting them go into captivity, that these were the first to be taken into captivity. They were the first to settle, and they were the first to go into captivity. For we read over in 1 Chronicles 5, beginning with the 25th verse, "And they transgressed against the God of their fathers, and went a-whoring after the gods of the people of the land, whom God destroyed before them. And the God of Israel stirred up the spirit of Pul, king of Assyria, and the spirit of Tigeth-Pileser, king of Assyria, and he carried them away, even the Reubenites, and the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh, and brought them unto Halah, Habor, Hara, and to the river Gozan, unto this day." So I just mentioned that to show that not only did they were they allowed to settle first, but because of the sins, they were also the ones carried away into captivity first. And it says the reason was because they went a-whoring after the gods of the people of the land, whom God destroyed before them. Now they destroyed these people. They destroyed Bashan and the king Og, and they destroyed Heshbon and King Sihon, but they still went after the gods that they left there, those idols. And so they were the first carried into captivity. Interesting thought to me. Now beginning in verse 18. "And I commanded you at that time, saying, The Lord your God hath given you this land to possess it." Oh, wait, excuse me, I'm on the wrong verse. Let's go down to verse 21. "And I commanded Joshua at that time, saying, Thine eyes have seen all that the Lord your God hath done unto these two kings. So shall the Lord do unto all the kingdoms whither thou passest." Now Joshua was to be the man who was the commander. He was the commander of the army. And he, to some extent, was to take the place of Moses. He didn't take all the place of Moses, but to some extent he did take the place of Moses. Moses gave him a part of his glory, we'll read about later. And the Lord then had Moses to tell Joshua that you've seen all that the Lord your God has done to these two kings, Og of Bashan and Sihon of Heshbon. So shall the Lord do unto all the kingdoms whither thou passest. Now this should have been a very, very encouraging fact. The Lord's going to do this same thing to all the kingdoms that you pass to, Joshua. You're going to have this power to completely annihilate everything that lies in your way. Every city can be taken and destroyed. All the people can be completely annihilated. "Ye shall not fear them, for the Lord your God, he shall fight for you." Now, you know, we have some promises in the Bible given to us that are very similar to this. The Lord's promised us that we'll have no temptation that's greater than we can bear, but that he'll provide with the temptation a way for us to escape. He's promised that. He's promised us that he chastens every son that he receiveth, and that the chastening is not going to be pleasant for the present time, but he does it to save us. He does it so that we'll be made better in his sight. And many, many promises. Promises of a resurrection from the dead. Promises that we're going to be allowed to enter into the joys of our Lord. And on and on and on. We don't think too much of these promises, but the same God that made this promise to Joshua made the promises that we have today. Same God. And these promises that he gave us today are no harder to give than the one that he gave to Joshua. So it should be heartening to us to know that when God promises something, he certainly lives up to it in every respect. Now beginning in verse 23. "And I besought the Lord at that time, saying..." Now this is Moses. Moses approached the Lord. Now all these things had taken place. Moses had been told he would not be allowed to enter into the land. So he decides to beseech the Lord now another time to see if God will in any way change his mind and let him go in and see the land. Verse 24. "O Lord God, thou hast begun to show thy servant thy greatness and thy mighty hand. For what God is there in heaven or in earth that can do according to thy works and according to thy might. Now Moses is giving God glory and praise. Whether this is actually a prayer or not, we don't know. It might not have been a prayer. It might have been just God, Moses taking the great privilege that was his to converse with God, a privilege which we may very well have today. The child of God should certainly be able to converse with God, express his thoughts to God. And he says, you've begun to show me, thy servant, your greatness and your mighty hand. For what God is there in heaven or in earth that could do according to thy works and according to thy might? What other God could possibly do the things you've done? Then verse 25, he says, I pray thee, let me go over and see the good land that is beyond Jordan, that goodly mountain and Lebanon. Moses pleads with God, let me go over. Let me see the good land. Let me see the good mountain, that goodly mountain, and Lebanon up at the northern part of Palestine. Let me see it. This is, you know, this had to be a desire of Moses. There's no way that Moses could be said to have no feeling about this and to say, oh, well, I did my job. It didn't make that much difference. I didn't get to see Canaan. He wanted to see it. At the very last year, he pleads with God. He begs him, let me go over. There's the river right there, just the other side of that river. The river wasn't all that terribly wide. There was times when that Jordan dried up to become stagnant pools, they say. And he could find a way over. Let me go over. Let me see it. But we find the next verse, but the Lord was wroth with me for your sakes, and would not hear me. And the Lord said unto me, let it suffice thee. Speak no more unto me of this matter. Now the Lord didn't even want to hear about it anymore. Don't even talk to me about it, Moses. Speak no more to me of this matter. He says, let it suffice thee. That is, the thing that you've had, the glory that you've had, the privileges, the opportunities that you've had, that which you have yet promised to you, although it does not include Canaan, let that suffice thee. A great, great lesson here for Moses, and a great lesson for us. When God has made up his mind about a thing, there's no use for us to think that we can cajole and plead and get God to change his mind some way. He says, I don't want to hear about it. No more about this matter. And Moses says, he was wroth with me. And he says, let it suffice thee. What we have that's given to us, there comes a time when we have to say, that's going to be sufficient for me. Maybe we won't see the thing that we've been dreaming of all of our life to see. Maybe we've been working for to fulfill a vision. I'm sure there have been many, many, many people in the church that have worked a lifetime to see a certain thing accomplished in the church. Maybe a certain amount of unity brought about. Maybe a certain number of congregations established. Maybe a certain number of people converted in a given community. Maybe a person in their family converted. A good friend converted. Maybe their children. But there has to come a time when they have to realize that I'm going to have to go through this life and not see that accomplished. I'll have to be satisfied with other things, maybe lesser things or different things, but I'll not see that done, regardless of how hard you want it done. Moses had spent the last 80 years or so of his life preparing for the going over into Canaan. He was 40 years in the wilderness serving his father-in-law. And then here the last 40 years of his life. And then the first 40 years of his life was he was living in Egypt. So he's now a man 120 years old. And so close, a stone's throw away from seeing his lifelong dream getting to go into Canaan. But because he had sinned against God, that God would not let him go in. Now, one interesting thing to me is that we stop and think about this sin that Moses committed. It was a time when the people were murmuring because they didn't have water. And God told Moses to go speak to the rock. He did, and he also took his rod and he struck the rock. But he did this in such a way that he apparently did not have the faith that he should have had, the belief that he should have had in God and God's power to really bring the people into the land of Canaan. He didn't represent God as he should, as really believing that he could and would do what he said he would do. And because of that disbelief, then Moses was not allowed to enter in. And we said it before, but let's say it again. One of the most important things that we can ever have in our dealings with God is to not lose our belief. Now, we can grow cold, and we can grow distant, and we can become forgetful, and we can become lax because we begin to lose our belief. Now, the way that you hold on to your belief is to frequently study and meditate on God's Word and associate with God's people and continually relate the things of God to your life. Because after so long a time of being away from God, nobody is strong enough to continue a belief. And so here Moses, he'd been in the wilderness for so long. He'd seen these people be so disobedient. He'd lost faith in the people. And finally, that one time, he lost his faith in God. And that was all it took. He couldn't enter in because of his unbelief. Now, this story is given in Numbers, the 27th chapter, verses 12 through 23. If anybody would like to turn over and read about it, it's explained over there in detail. He tells Moses why he couldn't go in. And we're going to get to that later and study some of that. So in verse 27 he says, "Get thee up into the top of Pisgah, and lift up thine eyes westward, and northward, and southward, and eastward, and behold it with thine eyes, for thou shalt not go over this Jordan." He tells Moses, you go up to Pisgah and you look. You take a look at the territory. But that's all you're going to get to do is to behold it with your eyes. You're not going to get to go over this Jordan. Now they tell me that Pisgah is one of the peaks there on Mount Nebo. Pisgah is a mountain about 4,500 feet high. It's a fairly brisk climb to the top, although it's not all that terribly steep. And 4,500 feet now is high enough that you can really see the area around about you. And he was to look in every direction. And as Moses went up on Pisgah, I don't know whether he just went one time or whether he went more than one time, because this is again told in the last chapter of Deuteronomy. Just before Moses died, he went up and he looked. But as he went up on Pisgah to look, let's imagine for a few minutes that we were there and that we were seeing what Moses would be able to see. As he looked over to the east, the eastern direction, he could see the land of Arabia. He could see flat plains. And he could see the area from whence, or the direction from whence Abraham came, Ur of the Chaldees. And he could also see the direction of that terrible place known as Babylon, which this very people, their descendants, several hundred years later, would be carried away into captivity by. The place where Daniel would be when Daniel faced Jerusalem as he prayed. As he looked to the south, he could look down and see Moab, land of his cousins. And on further down south of them, he could see the Midianites. And he could see the outline of Mount Hor and Mount Seir. And he could see the wilderness that they spent 40 years in, getting up to this point. Not all that far down there where it was. And then as he begins to turn on further from the south and look further towards the west, he could see way in the distance Egypt. Egypt, the land where they'd spent 400 years in captivity, the land of his birth, the land that they were allowed to be freed from as they crossed through the Red Sea, and the land of the mighty pharaohs. Egypt, the land that still controlled a lot of Canaan through governors and that exercised power in this very area. And as he began to turn that around on further west, he could look down at the foot of Mount Pisgah there, and he could see the Sea of the Plain, which is the Dead Sea, the Salt Sea. And from his vantage point, as the sun shined, you could see the reflection of the setting sun in the waters of the Sea of the Plain. And on beyond the coast then of the Dead Sea, there arose up the wilderness of Judea, the place where way yonder in the future would come John the Baptist. And John the Baptist is one who preached in this wilderness of Judea. And right down, as you look directly east from the mount, you could see where the Jordan River ran into it. And that's where John the Baptist did his baptizing. That's where Jesus was baptized. And that's where, very shortly after this, the children of Israel would cross over into the land. And as he looked on beyond the land then, he could see the mountainous backbone that goes on up to Jerusalem. Jerusalem, earlier called the city of Jebusalem, which means the city of peace, and later to be the great capital city of his people, and later to be the site of the temple itself. And as he looked on beyond, he could see the way in the distance, on a clear day, they say. You can see all the way across the land, and you can see the shoreline of the Great Sea, the Mediterranean Ocean. As you look on up that coastline, you can see Mount Carmel. And then you can see the plain of Sharon, and all the various places in that area of Palestine. And as he goes on north and looks way to the north, he could see up here Mount Hermon and the vicinity of the Sea of Galilee, some 60 miles to the north, and see this Jordan River as it makes its trek down through there. And the great Jordan Depression that was on either side of the Jordan River, it being the only river that's below sea level, and the Dead Sea the only sea that's below sea level. So here was Moses looking all these directions, looking at the land, but not able to go in, not allowed to go in. So it's quite an interesting thing. We wonder what all might have come to Moses' mind, knowing it's a clear-cut picture to us, knowing that he wanted to go. He says, let me go over and see that good land, but not allowed to go, all because of his disobedience. Then in verse 28, but charge Joshua, this is God talking to Moses now, but charge Joshua and encourage him and strengthen him, for he shall go over before this people, and he shall cause them to inherit the land which thou shalt see. Joshua was to be the one who was to some extent take the place of Moses. He was to be charged. He was to lead the people. And we learn that Moses gave him a part of his glory. That's taught in Numbers 27. Not all the glory, but a part of his glory. And then he got together with Eliezer, Joshua would, and Eliezer would, through the guidance given by God, would help to guide him. And Joshua's